a time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up, a time to weep, and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to get, and a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to cast away, a time to rend, and a time to sow, a time to keep silence, and a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time of war, and a time of peace. What profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. I know that there is no good in them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, it is the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, that men should fear before him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. And God requireth that which is past. And moreover, I saw under the sun the place of judgment, that wickedness was there, and the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work. I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them, and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. For that which befalleth the sons of men befalleth beasts. Even one thing befalleth them, as the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast. For all is vanity. All go unto one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now this Lord's Day morning, we come again to the book of Ecclesiastes. We've seen that this book is an evaluation of life under the sun. This phrase, under the sun, is repeated 33 times in this book. We've noted that the author Solomon says in verses 2 and 3 that the theme of this book is vanity of vanities, all is vanity. He there declares the theme, and then he explains it a little bit. He confirms it, or asks us to confirm it in our conscience in verse 3 of chapter 1. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? We heard that repeated as we've just read chapter 3. The author Solomon gives us a biographical sketch of his life. He shows us the various experiments, the various trials he involved himself in as he sought to find meaning to his life in these various isms. He sought pleasure, he sought human wisdom, he sought possessions, and he sought to find satisfaction in projects as well. But here he comes, and he draws an inference, I believe, from the conclusion that we found in verses 24 through 26. He gives us an extended explanation of that conclusion that he had just reached. He is telling us that we should cheerfully content ourselves with and make use of what God has given us. That's what he's calling us to hear in these verses. He does so by first speaking to us regarding the mutability of human affairs, or the changeableness of human affairs in verses 1 through 11. Then he speaks briefly of the immutability of God's counsels, that God's counsels, that God's decrees are unchangeable just as He is. And there in verses 12 through 15, Solomon gives us some implications, some applications that he has drawn from this conclusion that God's counsels are stable. And then in verses 16 through 22, he begins to speak about the vanity of worldly power. The vanity of worldly power. Let's look first at verses 1 through 11. He gives us first in verse 1 a general proposition. Then in verses 2 through 8, he gives us some proof of this proposition, of this assertion. And then in verses 9 through 11, he gives us some inferences, some applications that can be drawn from this fact. He says in verse 1, "To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven." You see those two words, "thing," there is three words that are italicized. They're not there in the original. Literally it reads, "to every a season and a time to every purpose under heaven." But the point is, everything has its season. The word "season" there in this verse means a fixed time. It's used in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and Esther to describe things, times appointed. It's used in Esther chapter 9, verses 27 and 31 regarding the appointment of the Feast of Purim. So it's speaking about an appointed or a fixed time. There is an appointed time or a season for every purpose. Here this word "purpose" is translated "pleasure" in chapter 5, verse 4 of this book, and chapter 12, verse 1. It literally means the thing that we choose to do. There's a fixed time by God for everything that we choose to do. Consider the words found in Acts 15, 18. "Known unto God are all His works from the beginning of the world." In other words, God knows what He's doing. God knows what He's doing. And so the psalmist could say in Psalm 31:15, and we ought to be able to say these things as well, "My times are in Thy hand." My times are in Thy hand. My life and what comes into my life is in Your hand, O God. It's not in my hand, but they're my times. They're in Your hands. And notice what the psalmist says. He goes on to say, "Deliver me." You're in control. My times are in Your hands. But nonetheless, the psalmist isn't a fatalist. He's in a situation where he desires deliverance and he asks God to deliver him. His time at that point was under oppression. He recognized that was from God and His sovereignty, and yet in recognizing that, he could still plead with God to get him out of it, to put him in another season in his life. And so must we. We must see that life is full of ups and downs, ordered by God for His people's good, for our good. And that's what I think he begins to tell us in verses 2 through 8, as we have the proof of this proposition. Ultimately, he's telling us that life is full of up and downs. Do you ever feel like you're on a roller coaster when you're not? I think most of us know what it's like to be on a roller coaster throughout our lives. Don't be shocked. There are ups and there are downs. And I think that is what Solomon is getting at here. He says there's a time to be born, there's a time to die, there's a time of happiness and a time of sadness. And he goes on in these things. Think of Psalm 34:23. "The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord." God's in control of sad times and happy times. births and deaths. A time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. You see, a time to plant is a time of joy. This time of plucking up is not speaking of harvest, it's speaking of having to pluck up that which didn't flourish. That which, because of too much rain or not enough rain, didn't come to fruition. There's a time to kill and a time to heal. There's a time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. Their dancing is in opposition to mourning. Dancing for joy. You see, all these are both positive and negative, showing us what it is to be down and what it is to be up. A time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. We probably don't throw away stones a whole lot and gather stones together a lot in our culture. But you see, for the Jew, what they're speaking of is demolishing and building up. Sometimes walls and buildings were demolished. Stones were broken up. They were cast away. Other times they were collected and then built upon to build landmarks, to build fences that divided properties, or to build buildings. That's what's being spoken of. Sometimes things are flourishing in your family life, in the church life, in the economic life of a country, and then other times things are being demolished. Great edifices are being built and other ones are being torn down. Literally and metaphorically as well. Great estates are built up and then they come crashing down through extravagance, through bad investments, what have you. There's a time to embrace. There's a time to refrain from embracing. There's a time to get and a time to lose. Here he's speaking of a time to make money and a time to lose money. Some of us have known what that's like through our lives, haven't we? There's a time when things seem to be going our way, money seems to be flowing in, and then sometimes the cash flow reverses at certain portions of our lives. He's saying all these things are ordered by God. A time to keep and a time to cast away. A time to save things, a time to give things away. A time to rend and a time to sow. We have to, again, picture these words in the Hebraic metaphor that is found, or the Hebraic mentality. A time to rend. The Jews rent their clothing when they were distraught. Speaking of a time of mourning. They would rend their clothes. And so, to sew must be speaking of then making clothes, clothes that they would put on for enjoyment. Remember, they wore special clothes when they went to a wedding. And so it's speaking of, again, a time of sadness and a time of joy. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. Again, it might be referring of mourning in relationship to joy. Quite often we are told to keep silent. We see the psalmist routinely saying, I kept silent before the Lord. When he was in a period of chastening, he didn't speak hastily oftentimes to the Lord. Sometimes he did. But we're not to speak hastily to God when He's bringing difficult things upon us for our good. But as I contemplated this phrase, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, these two phrases this week, I thought how often it is that each and every one of us falls into one of those categories. We either don't speak enough or we speak too much. Because of selfishness, we either don't speak enough, we don't enter into conversation with people, we don't show that we care about them enough to talk with them and engage them and be engaged by them. Some of us have that difficulty, and in other ones, we have the difficulty of always speaking. We're always running our mouth. We're always telling everybody else about us and not showing any interest in them. I think we all need that wisdom, that God-given wisdom, to recognize where do we fall? What's our natural tendency? Some of it's God-given in our temperament. Some of it's due to our sin. But what is that tendency we have? And I would contend those of us that have identified that tendency then can begin to work I tend to be too quiet. I need to be a little bit more outgoing so I can show love to others. Or I tend to speak too much. Maybe I need to curb my tongue and listen a little bit more. Remember Proverbs 25:11, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pictures of silver. I'm not going to try to explain what apples of gold in pictures of silver are today. I think you get the picture. A word spoken in the right time is beautiful. It has a positive effect. But it has to be spoken at the right time. And it's a word. It's not a diatribe or a treatise. He goes on, not only is there a time to keep silence, a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. 28 different situations referred to. One commentator says it's interesting that there are 28 days of the moon's revolution. He's showing life under the sun, life under the moon. Things are up and things are down. There's an appropriate time to do all these things as ordered by God. And application and inference, I think we could draw that we are called to be like Job. Remember Job in Job 1:21 when he lost so many of those things, but God had given them, even his family members. He says, "The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I praise you when you gave it to me. I'm praising you when you took it away from me. I didn't bring it to myself. You gave it. You're free to take it." That's the attitude we're to have. All these things are in God's hands. So even when we enter into a time of sadness, we know that God has ordered it for our good, and we're called to bless Him in spite of it. We can, as the psalmist, pray for deliverance. We ought to. But in the midst of what God's given us, let us not turn from God, but let us trust in our loving Heavenly Father. We see the general proposition, the proofs of the proposition. Now let us look at the inferences in verses 9 through 11. We have in verse 9 this question that's repeated. We saw it in verse 1 or verse 3 of chapter 1. We've seen it again in chapter 2, verse 22. We'll see it again in chapter 5, verse 16. This question, what profit hath he that worketh in that wherein he laboreth? What's the benefit? What's the bottom line of all the labor that a man does under the sun? Without reference to God, what is the benefit of all this labor that people are involved in? They're in the rat race. And what is the goal of the rat race if there is no God in the heavens? If there is no transcendent one, what value is there in living? He goes on and answers this, I think, with a couple inferences. He says in verse 10 that life can be and is frustrating. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. This word travail literally means employment or business. I have seen the business, I've seen the employment that God's given to the sons of men to be exercised. And this word literally comes from the word to depress. I've seen the business that God's given men to be depressed about. He's acknowledging it's not always easy. In Philippians 4:11, Paul says, I have learned how to both abound and to be abased. And that word there, that phrase, I have learned, means literally, I have learned by experience. Paul didn't learn it by just looking at the Word of God. He had learned it by God putting him in both situations. And one is certainly more enjoyable than the other. We all acknowledge that, don't we? You have to be a masochist to think that it's as good to be abased as it is to abound. But he learned in being abased, in not having what he desired to have, he learned to find contentment because he knew that that's what God had for him. So saying, under the sun, it's a mess. Men work, and what are they working for? They can't leave it to anyone. We saw last Lord's Day, and the one they leave it to may or may not properly handle what they do with it. They can't take it with them. When they leave it, who knows what will happen to it. And so he goes on in verse 11, I believe in verse 11a, to tell us we must make the best of what is. He hath made everything beautiful in His time. God has made everything beautiful or bright and pleasant in its appropriate time. When God brings us low, when God brings us high, it's beautiful. Do we recognize that? As frustrating as it may appear, it's beautiful. Do we have the eyes of faith to see our lives and the seasons, the times that God brings, as pleasant and bright? Knox and Thomas, stop now. Stop. We must make the best of what is. But he goes on in verse 11b. Also he hath set the world in their heart, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. Now we might ask, what in the world is Solomon getting at here? He hath set the world in their heart. I don't believe he's letting us know that we're worldly here. Though that's true, I don't believe that's the truth that's taught here. What I believe he's saying is that the world nature is set in our heart. That there's an innate drive given to us as those created in God's image to have dominion over the world that God has created. That's what he's speaking at. He set the world in our hearts, but at the same time, so that no man can find out the work that God maketh from the beginning to the end. What God's done in creation and in the world is so great. It's not infinite. He's infinite. The creation's not infinite, but to us, it's as good as infinite. We can't fully comprehend it. We can begin to search the depths of God's creation. We can, by observation, begin to learn about what He's done, but we never fully grasp it. The field is wide, our capacity limited. We can't grasp it all. But yet God's called us to this task. We have, even the non-Christian has this desire, drive to have dominion. There's a lot less of them today than it appears that used to have it. But there are many non-Christians that have done and been involved in many advances in science and in other fields, medicine and the like, for the good of all mankind, including us as Christians. And God has ordered that. There is this innate drive. We've got to make the best of what is, because it's beautiful. God's made it. He's placed us here to have dominion over His creation. The way I best understand this is that we need to view life, and this is simple, but we need to view life and see life as a tapestry on a loom. Some of you children may have never seen a tapestry or a carpet made on a loom. But the one that works the loom then takes thread and weaves it through warp and woof, one way and the other way, and begins to make a beautiful picture. But the picture is ordinarily only beautiful on one side. Have you ever looked at the other side of a mosaic? Have you ever seen one up on a wall? Or excuse me, a tapestry, and then turned it upside down and looked at the mess underneath? Threads going this way and that way of all different colors. And yet on the one side, this beautiful picture in thread. You see, Solomon's talking about the opposite side here, the ups and the downs. It looks pretty disordered, doesn't it? Without the eyes of faith, looking at life as just under the sun, without God, that's what life looks like. It's a mess. It makes no sense. But we have the eyes of faith, and we realize that all this is ordered by God, when we realize it's all beautiful in its time, then we begin to see the other side. There is order. There is symmetry. There is a rationale. These are all in God's decrees, in His counsels. So here, I think in verses 12 through 15, Solomon moves to speak of the immutability of God's counsels. He says in verse 12, I know from experience and from revelation, I believe, is the implication, that there is no good in them. Literally, it means that there is no good for them, but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. He goes on, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from it. And God doeth it, that men should fear before Him. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath been or hath already been. And God requireth that which is past. He's supporting, he's speaking of the immutability of God's counsels. Whatever God doeth, it shall be forever. You can't add to it, you can't subtract from it, he says in verse 14. But he gives us some principles to live by based on this truth. He says first in verse 12 and 13, let us be content with our lot. There's no good for them but to do good, but to enjoy eating and drinking with the fruit of their labors. It's a gift of God. He's telling us to do good. He's not encouraging us to gluttony and drunkenness, but He is admonishing the miser. He's saying these things have been given to thee. They're a gift from God. Use them properly. While you can, enjoy the things that God's given you. You may not have them, yes, tomorrow or the next day, but while you have them, enjoy them. One of the Wesleys said this one time. He said, make the most you can, give the most you can, save the most you can, spend the most you can. Good counsel. Good counsel. Obviously, you don't do that to the detriment of your family and your church, but nothing's wrong with making it, saving it, giving it, and also spending it. Not abusing it, but using the gifts that God's given. Because God's ordained them, and we ought to do so with thanksgiving to God, because it's His gift. But then he says that we should acquiesce to God's providence in verse 14a. I know that whatsoever God doeth, it shall be forever. Whatever He does, it's forever. Nothing can be put to it, nor anything taken from. In other words, you can't add or subtract. So stop trying to add or subtract to God's providence. We've already sung Psalm 33, verse 11. The counsel of the Lord standeth forever, the thoughts of His heart to all generations. The counsel of the Lord standeth forever, the thoughts of His heart to all generations. We should not be saying, if only this, if only I had done that, if only this would have happened, if only this. You see, it's right for us to ask, what if? What if I do this or that? What are the likely consequences? We know from the book of James that we can't make sure those consequences will come to pass. God has those things ordered. The future is uncertain. But we can make plans. We're called to make plans. But Paul says, I don't look backwards. I look forward. I press on to the knowledge of Christ. I don't second guess myself all the time. Yes, I learn from my mistakes, but I don't spend my life contemplating the past. I get past that evaluation and then I figure out what I've got to do in the future. It's not only our duty to bring our wills to God's will, it's also our interest. It's our duty to conform our wills to God's will, but it's also best for us. You see, children, sometimes what's best for us isn't what we like. Sometimes eating that spinach is not what you enjoy, but it's good for you. But you see, when you bring your will to God's will, it's not only your duty to do so, it's also your benefit. There's joy in submission to God's plan and to what God has brought about in your life. But then, I think we have this other implication that we should answer God's end in providence. Now, what does that mean? Verse 14, the very end, Solomon says, "And God doeth it." God's ordered all these things to fall out the way they do, that men should fear before Him. Are you increasing in the fear of God? If God is your Father, do you not think that is one of the primary things He's doing in your life to sanctify you? Can someone be growing in grace and not growing in the fear and reverence of God? Is that possible? Can you be growing in humility, growing downward in humility, and not be growing in reverence towards God? I contend it's impossible. You see, so God works these ups and these downs. These times when we're to be silent, these times when we're to speak, the times when we're to rend our garments in grief, our times when we're to sew or go purchase, if we don't sew, garments for an occasion of joy. And we're to do so, recognizing that it's from God, and that God is working these things for His good, to His glory and our good. He's building in us the fear of Him. But lastly, in verse 15, we see that we should acknowledge God's stable, immutable government. That which hath been is now, and that which is to be hath already been. And God requireth that which is past. This is a perfect example of why Ecclesiastes is one of the hardest books to interpret in Scripture. Because this Hebrew poetry is complex and it's hard to grasp. I believe what Solomon is saying here is that God in general deals with us the same way He's always dealt with His people. He's not saying that life repeats itself exactly. He's not contending for a cyclical view of history, but what He's saying is the way He's acted in the past is not different at the core than the way He deals now. Matthew Henry understood it this way. He said, "The world as it has been and is will be constant in inconsistency." The world will be constant and inconsistency. It's been a disarray looking at it without God in the picture all along. And it will continue to be for those that look at life without God in the picture. It will always look like the backside of that tapestry. It will always be a mess. But when we have the eyes of faith, when we have the mind of Christ, and we look at our lives in light of God's immutable counsels, then that tapestry is beautiful. Then what God is putting us through right now is beautiful. It's pleasant. It's bright. Because it's exactly what God has wanted for us. And so we need to acknowledge His stable government. We've seen the mutability or the changeableness of human life in verses 1 through 11. We've seen the immutability of God's counsels in verses 12 through 15. Now let us look at the vanity of worldly power. Solomon has spoken about these vanities already. He's spoken of the vanity of possessions, of human wisdom, of power, of pleasures, and projects. Now he comes to worldly power. Some see this as Solomon moving now to some objections to the doctrine of God's sovereignty or providence. And that may or may not be. But he certainly brings up some issues, some things we have to think about. If God's in control, then why are these things so? He speaks first of the vanity of mighty men in verses 16 and 17, then the vanity of mortal men in verses 18 through 21. And then he wraps up this section again with verse 22, an inference drawn that's very similar to the conclusion that he reached at the end of chapter 2. He speaks first of the vanity of mighty men. Verse 16, he says, "The judge will not judge aright." In this world, judges often don't judge properly, do they? "And moreover, I saw under the sun, the place of judgment, that wickedness was there. In the place of righteousness, that iniquity was there. In other words, I went to the place of judgment, the place where righteousness should have been upheld, and it wasn't. Because judges are often fought. Judges often aren't acting on God's behalf. They don't recognize themselves to be the minister of God. And in our day, oftentimes it's so because ungodly men will keep godly men from that post. So there may be those that desire to be in that place and act for God and judge for God. They can't get there. But he says in verse 17, I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every word. He says the judge will be judged for not judging properly in verse 17. He says, I said in my heart, in other words, he comforted himself, he counseled himself, even though that was true, there's another truth. He says, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. This word judge here means to adjudicate. Doesn't mean he'll condemn both the righteous and the wicked. What it means is he will evaluate, he will adjudicate. He will condemn the wicked and he will absolve or acquit the innocent, the righteous. Remember the words of Paul in Acts 17:31 on Mars Hill. He, God, hath appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man, Jesus Christ, whom he hath ordained. In the midst of all the unrighteousness in our courts today, let us remember this truth. Solomon found comfort there. That's where we should find comfort as well. God's in control. They're going to pay. Their judgments will be judged. They will be evaluated. Nothing will be hidden on that day. Then he moves to the vanity of mortal man in verses 18 and following. I said in my heart concerning the estate of the sons of men that God might manifest them and that they might see that they themselves are beasts. What Solomon's saying is he's showing his desire. He's saying if they would ever understand their honor, their dignity, as those created in God's image, they've got to come to understand their shame. And I wish they would see that in their perspective, life lived out under the sun without God, all they are is animals. Oh, that they would see it, he says. It's very interesting. Apparently Bonaparte sensed that to some degree. Not that he came to saving faith, but on his dying bed he said this, I die before my time, and my body will be given back to the earth to become food of worms. Such is the fate which so soon awaits the great Napoleon. What an abyss between my deep wretchedness and Christ's eternal kingdom, proclaimed, loved, adored, and spread through the world. There's no evidence that Napoleon came to a saving knowledge of Christ. But as he looked on his life, as he's about to die before he expected to, he came to see that in his philosophy, all he was about to be food for the worms. That's the way he had lived his life. That's all that he could expect. Matthew Henry says, it is not strange that those live like beasts who think they shall die like beasts. Why do you think our culture is in such bad shape? When for years and years and years, the children of this nation have been told that they're just apes in trousers and in dresses. Why would you expect them to live anything different than that? That was Solomon's desire, that men might see that. He gives the reasons why. He says, because under the sun, in verses 19 and 20, in that perspective, they go to the same place as the animal. For them, their life is no better at the end than the animal. But then he contrasts this in verse 21. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward, and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? It's a rhetorical question. Who knows it? In other words, very few people get it. Very few people recognize that man, created in God's image, is body and soul, and that soul will go to meet its maker in judgment. And will then either be with his maker or her maker in eternal bliss, or will be separated from their maker in eternal damnation. He says, few get it. Few understand it. You see, Paul could say in 2 Timothy 1:10 that immortality is brought to light by the gospel. It's through the gospel that we realize our lives go on. Yes, there may have been some Greek philosophers and other false religions that believed in a life hereafter, but it's only the gospel that fully brings it to life that all of men will be accountable to their Maker. I have a question. Will your spirit, will your soul be made perfect at death? You see, it's only the just whose souls will be made perfect and will spend eternity with God. All of men will spend eternity somewhere. But where will you spend eternity? Paul speaks of the spirits of just men made perfect in Hebrews 12:23. Whose souls, whose spirits are made perfect? Just men. Very interestingly, children, that word men there is in italics again. It's not there. In the Greek, it just says the spirits of the just made perfect. The just, male or female. Whoever sins have been pardoned, whoever has been made righteous in God's sight through the imputed righteousness of Christ, their souls and their souls only will be made perfect at death. Can you say with full assurance what the psalmist says here in Psalm 49, 14 and 15? God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for He shall receive me. Words of faith. Can we say that with full assurance? We need to be able to, because we are not beasts. Our spirits will go to our Maker. There will be only the judgment after death. And then either eternal damnation or eternal bliss. And then we come to verse 22. Solomon here has an inference drawn really from the whole section, a repeat of what we've seen in verses 24 through 26 of chapter 2. He says, live a cheerful life. Wherefore I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works. He should live a cheerful life. He should rejoice in his own works, not worship his works. Remember those that worship their drag? Fishermen that were taking in great amounts of fish, and they began to worship their instruments of work. No, we don't worship the instruments of our labor. We don't worship the fruit of our labor, but we're to rejoice in it because it's God's gift. God's given it to us. Are we thankful for it? Whether it's a lot or a little. Think of Proverbs 12:27. The slothful man roasteth not that which he took in hunting, but the substance of a diligent man is precious. The slothful man roasteth not that which he took in hunting. He's lazy. Who knows how he caught something hunting being lazy, but he did. And now he's too lazy to skin the animal and cook the animal so that he can eat it. He's going to lose what he's got because he's slothful. But what about the possessions, whether they be many or few, given them to him? And that's what Solomon is getting at when he gives us two reasons why we should live a cheerful life and rejoice in our works. For, that is his portion, for who shall bring him to see what shall be after him? two reasons why we should live a cheerful life, why we should rejoice in the gifts that God's given us. First, for it is His portion or allotment. It's His portion. It's not somebody else's. It's exactly what God has given Him. It's His portion. It's His allotment. Have you ever thought about that? God's given us an allotment. The all-wise God has given us this and somebody else that for a reason. If we thought about that more, would it keep us from wanting to get what they have? Wouldn't we realize we're best off having what God's given us? There's nowhere better than to be in the place of God's will, to have exactly what He's given us and be happy with it. Then He goes on, "For who shall bring him to see what shall be hereafter?" Or be after him. We can't see what's coming up. We don't know what's around the corner. Yes, we can save for a rainy day. Yes, we can save because the Bible says it's appropriate to leave an inheritance. The Bible says it's appropriate to recompense your parents. Yes, there's reasons to do that. And at the same time, you don't know what's around the corner. Enjoy some of what God's given you now. You don't know what's coming. Isn't that what Christ is getting at in Matthew 6:34? And we'll end with this. There He says, "Take therefore no thought for the morrow, for the morrow shall take thought for the things itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Do you get what He's saying there? It's not the easiest to understand in the King James. What He's saying is, don't worry about tomorrow. He's not saying don't plan for tomorrow, don't plan for next year, don't plan 5 years ahead or 10 years ahead in your family or in your business. No, He's not saying that. But He's saying don't worry about it. "For tomorrow shall take thought for the things itself. Sufficient is the day, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof." In other words, He's saying don't be paralyzed in the present worrying about what might happen in the future. Your duty is now. Your duty then will be then. What you have control about is now, not then. Don't be paralyzed worrying about what is around the corner. Enjoy the straight path you have right now and the things you have right now. And when you get around the corner, by God's grace, submit to His will in those things as well. That's what He calls us to. He says that looking at that tapestry from the backside looks like a mess. It's a life of ups and downs. It's a life on the roller coaster. Weeping and rejoicing. Mourning and rejoicing. Rending, sowing, living, dying. All these things. Life under the sun. But life with the perspective of the eternal is this beautiful tapestry that's ordered by God. It's His decree. It's His counsel. And He's working it out to His glory.